Today on the show, how to win friends and influence people. Here's a hint. It takes money. From American Public Media, this is The Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, June 10th, and thank you for joining us. We've been talking trade a lot on this program lately, and today two things are happening in that department. Earlier today, the White House said it is confident that the House will approve fast-track authority, letting the president complete trade deals quickly and without Congress making any changes after the fact. Well, some leaked information today could give them pause. A few draft pages of the mostly secret Trans-Pacific Partnership showed up on the WikiLeaks website and in the New York Times. And as it's written now, the TPP seems to give drug companies more power to set pricing for their medicines and might even let them influence how foreign governments roll out new medical products. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn tells us how all that got in there.
To industry lobbyists, a big trade deal is like a pot of honey to a swarm of flies. And the pharmaceutical industry has more than 1,000 of them, lobbyists that is, costing about $230 million a year, according to Lee Drutman, author of The Business of America is Lobbying.
Their strategy on TPP lobbying has been to lobby early and to lobby often.
One of the industry's key goals has been to protect drug makers' intellectual property. But Judith Rios-San Juan of Doctors Without Borders says some of those protections that have come out in other leaks could drive up drug prices in the developing world by freezing out cheaper generic versions.
Just to give you one example, if a pharmaceutical company modifies an existing medicine, they will be allowed to obtain additional patents and therefore extend their monopoly for additional 20 years.
That's 20 years they couldn't use the kind of generics that have, for example, brought down the price of HIV medication from $10,000 to $100 a year per patient. But Jay Taylor at the lobbying organization Pharma says those fears are overblown, and they miss a key point about incentives.
You know, you always have to go back to the fundamental premise that generic medicines would not exist but for the innovative drug that preceded them.
This argument is one you can be sure the U.S. Congress and trade representative have heard a lot, according to Drutman, the lobbying expert.
The drug industry is lobbying a lot more than the groups that might represent an alternative viewpoint.
But for alternative viewpoints, there are 11 other countries in the negotiations. I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
From trade deals to bond yields, government bond yields are going up. In fact, they've been rising for a couple months now, but today they hit new highs for the year, not just in the U.S., but also in Japan, Germany, and the United Kingdom. And a lot of investors are selling their government bonds right now. The question is, why? Marketplace's Nova Sappho has the story.
If the bond market is doing well, it could be that the rest of us aren't. That's according to Marilyn Cohen of Envision Capital Management.
The bond market doesn't like growth. It likes recession much better between the two.
Because when there's economic uncertainty, investors often flee to the safety of government-issued debt. So what does it mean when investors go bearish on bonds?
Things are looking better in the economy as far as housing starts, housing sales, durable goods are looking a little bit better, and certainly car sales are looking spectacular.
Cohen says even Europe is doing better than expected, which is why bond yields are rising there too. There is, though, a dark side to all of this, says Karen Petru of Federal Financial Analytics.
We're really looking at the unintended result of well-intentioned crisis reforms.
Those reforms? Requiring banks to hold on to more cash, so they're not playing as big a part in buying and selling bonds. Petru says that's leading to
significant structural changes in the bond market that have the financial system very, very spooked.
Spooked, but not in crisis mode, says Marilyn Cohen. That would happen if lots more bonds get sold off at once. For the time being, she says, these rising yields will nudge interest rates slightly higher, and that should be good for Wall Street and for Main Street.
Most baby boomers that are living on fixed incomes will be very happy that interest rates go up.
Because, Cohen says, that means their monthly retirement incomes will go up, too. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Speaking of up on Wall Street today, finally, some happy music. We'll have more when we do the numbers. Not long ago, Star Wars creator George Lucas announced plans to pay for an affordable housing project on land he owns in Marin County in Northern California. Marin County, if you're not familiar, is very beautiful and very wealthy. Lucas has lived there for decades. He's had several fights with fellow residents over building proposals. But his plan to spend upwards of $100 million of his own dollars on low-income apartments highlights a bigger story in Marin, just how hard it can be to build affordable housing in such an unaffordable area. From our Wealth and Poverty Desk, Chrissy Clark reports.
Okay, let's just get this part out of the way. And that's the last you're going to hear about George Lucas in this story for a while. I'll get back to his role in a bit, Star Wars fans, I promise. But first, I want to focus on the, yes, less sexy sounding part of the story, affordable housing. In a pricey place like Marin County, affordable housing can sometimes just sound like a joke. Lily Thomas is a planner who works for the county, and she says when she tells people what her job is...
I work for the County of Marin, and I manage the affordable housing program.
She gets reactions like this.
Oh, I didn't know you had any affordable housing. I thought that was an oxymoron.
This one time in the exam room of a new doctor, when she was about to get a physical, she happened to mention her job.
He laughed, said, I need affordable housing. I'm a doctor, and I can't afford to live in this county.
Maybe the doctor was kidding, but maybe not. Marin County has some of the most expensive housing in the nation, not just because it's such a beautiful place, think beaches, redwoods, and rolling hills, but also because it's right next to San Francisco's booming tech economy, and yet has very limited housing stock. More than 80% of Marin has been set aside never to be developed. And when you take an extremely limited housing supply and mix it with an extremely high housing demand, well, you know how this formula works.
Housing prices go up.
Way, way up. In Marin, the average monthly rent for a one-bedroom apartment is more than $1,700. The median home price is more than $800,000, meaning your annual income has to be at least $200,000 to qualify for most home loans. All these numbers have turned Marin into a place of extremes. It has one of the highest median incomes and highest levels of income inequality in the nation. Lots of high earners call it home, movie stars, lawyers, and yes, doctors. But middle-income folks, teachers and nurses, not so much. And low-income workers, busboys and housekeepers and baristas, they mostly cluster in Marin's few high-density areas near the freeway, sometimes doubling or tripling up in units so they can afford them.
Two families or three families to an apartment.
This is Sharon Minchef, a caregiver for the elderly who lived in one of those overcrowded apartment buildings in Marin until a few years ago. Then she lost her job and couldn't even afford her apartment anymore. For a few months, she was homeless.
Loss of job, loss of income, just everything happened all at once in my life. And I was at the age where there's not a lot of options out there for you unless you're really prepared for it.
The story of where Minchef ended up after this says a lot about how desperately needed affordable housing is in a place like Marin, and yet how hard it can be to build. After Minchef lost her home, she found her way to a shelter. The waiting list to get into most affordable housing units in Marin is more than 10 years long. But because Minchef was a low-income senior who'd been homeless, her wait was shorter, 4 years. Eventually, she was notified about an open unit at this new affordable complex called Tucson Senior Apartments.
This was a miracle. This was a miracle.
I went to visit Tucson Apartments. It's one of the few affordable housing projects that have been built in Marin in the last 5 years. So this is the community room?
The community room and the office.
It's in one of Marin's most expensive towns, Kentfield. The complex is this little cluster of 13 apartment units designed to blend in as well as they can with the multi-million dollar homes further up the street.
They're like the place on the corner over there is like a Tuscan villa.
Sharon Minchef loves her new home.
I feel like I'm living in the mountains and it's affordable.
Technically, affordable means that no more than 30% of a resident's income goes toward rent. But as Minchef shows me around the complex,
this is Jim.
Introduces me to residents.
Hi, Chrissy.
She says she's discovered affordable housing projects like hers also carry a different meaning in certain parts of Marin.
That you're going to get low-life, drug addict people. And that's not what's here. I so want, sometimes want to stand up and yell and scream, you know, that's not what comes here. You don't understand.
One fellow that lives here, he lived in a storage unit for 4 years before he got this place.
This is Mary Stomp, the CEO of the nonprofit PEP Housing that built Tucson Senior Apartments.
I mean, imagine you're 75 years old and you're living in a storage unit.
Others had been living in their cars before they moved here, or couch surfing, which meant when they came here, they didn't need moving vans.
They had nothing. So I went out and bought 10 beds, just basics, cookware, dishes, things like that, chairs, dining room tables. I think I bought 8 dining room tables because they had nothing.
Tucson is one of those rare examples of success in the world of affordable housing in Marin. Not just that 13 people struggling to keep a roof over their head now have an affordable home to live in, but that the housing even got built in the first place. Mary Stomp explains what that took.
The project is 13 units, and we had 19 sources of funding on it.
Let that sink in for a moment. Apartments for 13 people took 19 sources of funding, even though the whole project only cost $5 million to build. I asked Stomp to list the funding sources, and this alphabet soup of government agencies and grants and tax credits came tumbling out.
ARRA funds,
CDBG funding,
project-based Section 8,
federal and state
county
tax credits,
housing development
grant
funds,
from Marin Community Foundation,
through a bank,
construction loan.
Oh my God, and 9 others.
And each of these funding sources came with a different set of rules about what exactly their pot of money could be used for.
You know, this source has to pay for this thing, and that bench over there gets paid through this.
You're pointing to a bench?
A bench. Just one bench, and that's not one of the 19 sources. So each bench you see, just add another source, add another source. This is what kept me up at night, is trying to figure out what was going to pay for what. If you see my spreadsheet, it's very large, and it can be mind-blowing.
I started looking around the apartment complex we were standing in, all the walls and windows and doorknobs, and started to see each little detail as the physical manifestation of 19 columns on a spreadsheet, not to mention hours of paperwork, phone calls, grant applications.
Like, what about the garden?
The garden was paid for by tax credits.
What about the actual buildings?
A permanent loan with Marin Community Foundation.
And some American Recovery Act money, she said, except for the balconies and the patios, because
American Recovery Act money doesn't pay for balconies and patios.
So they came out of a different funding stream. Oh, and the sidewalks leading up to the buildings?
That's CDBG funding.
You get the picture. Aside from this crazy quilt of funding, the other complication is that in recent years, a lot of funding sources have just gone away altogether because of budget cuts at the federal and state level. All of which is why Mary Stomp is so excited about her latest affordable housing project, the one she just started working on. It's planned for a former piece of dairy land in northern Marin County called Grady Ranch. It'll be one of the biggest affordable housing complexes in the county, more than 200 units. And there will not be 19 sources of funding, but just one. Yes, George Lucas. He said through a spokesperson that he just wanted to do something nice for seniors and people who work in Marin. I asked to talk to Lucas directly, but was declined. So you're just going to have to listen to this music instead. Anyway, Mary Stomp's spreadsheet for this new affordable housing project is a lot simpler than usual.
It's sort of an unbelievable miracle. It's got one column.
Stomp took me out to the land where this new development is planned to go.
Just stunningly beautiful here. All you see are hills and nature and beauty, and it's just an incredible place for someone to call home.
But not everyone feels that way about this new affordable housing project that George Lucas will be funding.
I go hiking in that area. You think we're not going to be able to see that thing?
It would stand out as a sore thumb, so to speak.
Basically, it looks like you volunteered
us
for the ghetto, basically.
More on that tomorrow. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I think every day we meet people who tell us, you know, I still love my BlackBerry, I'm addicted to it. Others talk about it like an old flame that they miss.
The boom and bust of the once beloved BlackBerry. But first, let's do the numbers. That's actually the euphoric music tinged with relief. The Dow Jones Industrial Average bounded up 236 points, 1.3%, to hit 18,000 on the nose. The NASDAQ clawed back 62 points, 1.25%, to close at 5076. The S&P 500 cranked 25 points, 1.2%, to finish at 2105. Netflix bounced 3.7% higher after the shareholders approved an increase in the number of shares the company can issue. Investors say that's a sign the company is getting ready to split its stock. Etsy shares rallied 5% on news that Tiger Global Management has raised its stake in the company. Bond prices fell, as you heard earlier. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.48%, and you are listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is listener-supported. To keep our coverage relevant and compelling, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift, in any amount, will count twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Newman's Own Foundation. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at Marketplace.org by June 30th.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department will report on retail sales for the month of May. The Labor Department will release weekly jobless claims. And we've all done it. We've all faked a cough or a cold to skip school. Guess what movie premiered on this day in 1986?
Bueller. Bueller. Bueller.
Ooh, I know. Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I'm Daisy Palacios.
You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Now for a look at traffic and weather. Well, weather anyway. It's raining in California today. Just a few drops, though, so yep, still in a drought. Yesterday, we talked about car washes. As California's utilities enact their mandatory conservation rules for water, the next target is the swimming pool industry. KQED's Lauren Summer has more.
Mark Hannigan normally talks fountains and filters with customers here in the showroom of Royal Pools in San Jose. But these days, the drought comes up first.
They want to know. Our customers who are under contract, whose pools are underway right now, are asking, is there going to be water to fill my pool?
It's a real question because almost 30 California cities and water agencies have banned filling new pools with potable water. Others are in the process, which doesn't surprise Hannigan. He says pools are an easy target.
It is very symbolic, and it looks good, banning swimming pools. Swimming pools don't waste water like people think they do.
This is the message that Hannigan has been taking to every city council meeting he can get to. Yes, at first, pools need a lot of water, 20 to 30,000 gallons to fill them. But after that, he says they don't need as much, just topping off. A lawn can guzzle 20,000 gallons every year.
You put a cover on those pools, evaporation is done. Fully half the pools we build here have automatic covers on them.
According to one study by a Southern California water district, over the years, a pool can actually save water compared to grass. But it takes 3 to 5 years to reach that break-even point. Some water utilities say that's too long to wait because they're facing steep cutbacks this year, up to a third of their water use. So the drought rules they're adopting are designed to send a message.
The tens of thousands of gallons it takes to fill a pool may not matter much in the aggregate.
That's San Jose Mayor Sam Liccardo.
But the reality is that compared to the necessity of the use of water for drinking, for our everyday needs, pools simply aren't that high a priority.
Other cities say the same thing. In a drought as serious as this one, with no end in sight, only essential uses of water should be allowed.
We're all in this thing together, and that means we all need to tighten our belts. And in some ways, that's not always comfortable.
Mark Hannigan says the pool industry is already feeling pretty uncomfortable.
What we don't know is how many people aren't calling. How many people want a pool and been waiting after 4 or 5 years of recession? Now they have the money and the wherewithal to put a pool in, and they're not calling.
For now, Hannigan is getting creative. In one Bay Area city, his company is planning on filling a new pool by draining an old one and trucking the water over. I'm Lauren Summer for Marketplace.
Once upon a time, really not that long ago at all, everyone who was anyone had a BlackBerry. Remember that? And then kind of all of a sudden, nobody had a BlackBerry anymore. The company is still working on a comeback, and in the meantime, two journalists, Jackie McNish and Sean Silkoff, have written a new book about the Canadian giant that, for a brief moment, was the most innovative wireless device company in the world. The book is called Losing the Signal, the untold story behind the extraordinary rise and spectacular fall of BlackBerry. Jackie and Sean, thanks for being here.
Hello.
Hi, Molly.
It feels so long ago and yet not long ago at all that BlackBerry was totally ascendant. How did they manage to create such an addictive product?
They were part of a race at the time in the 90s. Everyone was trying to create a mobile device, but no one could get email and text right. Everyone was making devices that were just overcomplicated, little keyboards with, you know, you need to be a little squirrel to tap on those small keyboards. Mike Lazaridis, who was the founder of Research in Motion, came up with the idea of a keyboard that would have slightly larger keys, but you would use your opposable thumbs. And the keyboard arced, and it was so simple and intuitive, you didn't need a manual.
And in large part, I mean, the book very much, and rightly so, credits the rise of BlackBerry to really the unique personalities of Jim Bozzoli and Mike Lazaridis. Talk about what particular skills these guys brought.
Yeah, I mean, they couldn't have been more different. Mike's story is he's sort of the classic son of immigrants from Turkey. I mean, he's the child genius who created a record player out of Lego when he was 4 years old. And he had a very influential teacher in high school who told them, the person who figures out how to marry computers and wireless is going to create something special. That was in the 1970s. So, you know, he was a very confident, brilliant scientist. He decided to start a company, dropped out of university at the University of Waterloo. And it's interesting. So Jim Bozzoli is the son of sort of lower middle class parents from small town Ontario, ends up in Harvard Business School. But he always had sort of a bit of a chip on his shoulder, I think, and sort of an insecurity because, you know, he didn't come from the world that a lot of his classmates came from. When he got to Harvard, he told us, you know, I felt like there were 89 Nobel Prize winners and one fraud. Instead of heading to Wall Street like all of his classmates, he sort of took a sharp turn, figured that, you know, if he was going to find his place in the world and reach the top, then the technology industry was a good place to go. So he ends up meeting Mike. His company is actually trying to squeeze a better deal out of Mike on a contract. And Mike sees in Jim an absolute shark. And Jim sees in Mike sort of a brilliant, totally ambitious technologist who kind of needs a little help on the business front.
So they create this product. This product changes the world, arguably is the reason that nobody has ever paid attention in a meeting since. But who were the people who really propelled BlackBerry onto the mainstream stage?
I think BlackBerry knew that it was going to be a success when they were still in a very small office in Waterloo. And they get a call from some guy in Texas who says, I'm trying to figure out how to hook this up. And it was Michael Dell. And they thought it was a joke at first because it was just so early into the launching of the product that it caught them by surprise. Oprah was a big early promoter and advocate. And then pretty soon, everyone from Madonna to, you know, prominent actors and musicians.
And so the book, obviously, the real BlackBerry story takes sort of a sharp turn. What happened? I feel like it's hard to find a takeaway from a business perspective.
I think the most important takeaway from this story is that this is the fastest technology race and most disruptive, brutish race of our generation. And the margin for error for BlackBerry was in 2007 when Steve Jobs walked onto that stage in San Francisco and held up the iPhone. The BlackBerry brought us a piece of the internet. It brought us email. What Steve Jobs was offering was basically essentially a mini computer in the smartphone. And because Mike Lazaridis' first response when he looked at the iPhone, took it apart in his home, he said, this will never work. It will crash the networks. Because they had grown up in an environment where the carriers ruled the world. But what he didn't understand was the degree and the speed with which there would be upgrades on the networks. Steve Jobs had reinvented that power struggle with the carriers. And at that moment, they went from being innovators to followers.
And now, let's talk about the position that BlackBerry is in now. You've got the new CEO, John Chen. You say in the book that in many ways he is producing BlackBerries for a niche market. It's for the people who love BlackBerry. But is that enough to sort of stick with the past?
It's amazing. You know, I think every day we meet people who talk about it like an old flame that they miss. And John Chen is, you know, is a very capable turnaround CEO. He's got the company to a point where it's not losing money. It's still sitting on about $3 billion in cash, and it has a lot of value in the company still. So, I mean, this book is not a eulogy for BlackBerry by any means.
Right. The story is not over.
Right. That's right.
Jackie McNish and Sean Silkoff are the authors of Losing the Signal. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This final note before we say goodbye and go kick back and enjoy a nice refreshing beverage. It seems possible that one very enthusiastic YouTube campaign could lead to the return of Crystal Pepsi. Remember Crystal Pepsi from the 90s? It was like Pepsi, but it was clear. Well, this guy on YouTube who goes by LA Beast started a campaign to bring back Crystal Pepsi. And since he has 1.2 million subscribers, he got a letter from Pepsi addressed to Mr. Beast, suggesting he might be happy with something the company has in store. Yep. Next up, grunge rock. That's a 90s joke. That's it. That's our show. And it was a good day. Today, the Dow bounded up 236 points, 1.3%. The NASDAQ came back 62 points, 1.25%. And the S&P 500 up 25 points, 1.2%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineered this program for us. I'm Molly Wood, and yep, I'll be back here again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.